public policy is turning on the subject of climate change, but that takes work when it gets down to policy. The closer you get, the more work it looks like it takes. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. The new report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is being drafted right now, and everything looks worse than it did in 2006. But policy? Well, they're all about science. They avoid policy. What should the policy steps be? Our number, 1-800-478-8255, toll free. Email talk@APRN.org.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Policy call. What's the policy call on climate change? Well, actually, you know, there's all sorts of policy response going on, and there's marketplace response even now. And science can't figure that part out either. I mean, if you think about it, the decline in economic growth is also going to lead to a decline in energy consumption. And one would assume, although one does not see it in the measurements yet, a decline in carbon emissions, which is good because carbon emissions were running way ahead of even the most lavish estimates of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change over the last 3 years. We'll get back to the IPCC later on, but let's go to someplace a little closer to home, like right here in Alaska. I'm not talking about the Arctic. I'm talking about Homer, because when it comes to policy on climate warming, I think they may be ahead of just about anybody because they set up a City of Homer Global Warming Task Force, and I have the chairman of that task force on the phone now, Alan Parks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hey, good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Now, you guys have been in existence for how long?
Well, the Global Warming Task Force for the City of Homer actually disbanded when we presented our climate action plan to the Homer City Council on December 10th, I believe.
That means you're going to be carbon neutral from now on. Right.
Well, that would be a perfect world. That would be a perfect world to be carbon neutral, and that's what people should be thinking about.
So you guys put yourselves out of business. You've solved all our problems for us.
Well, you know, one can only hope. We have some ideas. That's about it. We have ideas. We have a plan. We have ambition, and I think we're moving forward. And there's a lot of people in Alaska moving forward on it. And Homer does have a climate action plan, but there is so much great stuff going on in coastal communities to reduce the footprint and address global climate change and ocean acidification.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that one up. We've been dwelling on that on this program, and it's kind of a problem nobody wants to look at quite yet. This is a little too scary.
Well, you know, I think part of it is scary when you really dive into the information on ocean acidification, but there are solutions, and they're, you know, reducing emissions is the basic solution, and then that kind of gets into the devil in the details about how are we going to move our economy forward in to meet the IPCC recommendations of emission reductions.
Yeah, and of course there's a new IPCC report that's being drafted now, and it is, you know, I got a kind of a sneak peek on the stuff they were thinking about in Chicago last week. And it really does appear that, you know, we're outstripping every scenario right now in terms of the actual carbon that's going into the atmosphere. But we're not really seeing it in the climate. It was not for a change the warmest year on record last year, for instance.
Right.
Yeah. But still, you know, the IPCC is easy to criticize. But at the same time, in a sense, in a public policy sense, it's almost unassailable. The very thing that makes it so easy to criticize is also its greatest strength, which is that this is a consensus of science, and it's a very strong consensus process in which each country has a veto power. So any statement that they make is going to be quite conservative, really.
No, that's right. And that is an incredible document to come up with a scientific consensus, and they've gone through an extensive process in getting there, and there's, you know, some criticism amongst scientists about, you know, the modeling that has gotten to their conclusions, and you know, there's no doubt about it that, you know, from what I've been hearing, that the models were, for lack of better terms, just kind of watered down to meet that consensus. And so it's important to keep that in mind, and it'll be interesting to see what type of upgrades or projections that come out of Chicago.
Yeah, well, Chris Field from Stanford has agreed to come on the show later on. He just couldn't make it today. But during the panel in Chicago, the question of the models came up, and the problem, of course, is that the models underpredicted all the sensitivities. And they said, "Well, what about that? What about that makes you credible?" was kind of the question. And he said, "You can rest assured that the modeling community is thoroughly chastened."
Yeah. That's, well, you know, he'd definitely be the one to, you know, one to talk specifically about the models, but you can just look at, you know, as example, the ice melt, you know, that's happening, and how that's exceeded the projections. And when you look at CO2 in the water and ocean acidification, and that's accelerating at a rate from what scientists predicted. And so we're definitely the urgency of addressing global climate change and doing everything we can on an individual, local, state, and federal level should be, you know, a top priority.
Well, okay, we're down to doing what we can. And you may no longer have your task force there in Homer, but at the same time, you do work for the Alaska Marine Conservation Council of Coastal Communities and have a meeting coming up later this week in Homer among the coastal communities?
Yeah, that's right. We're Alaska Marine Conservation Council. You know, our work is about bringing, excuse me, yeah. Our work is with coastal communities, and we've been doing outreach trips throughout the state for the past couple of years, talking about the Homer Climate Action Plan and the process that we did here in Homer, and what AMCC was able to do in support of local people taking action. And in doing that work, we came to kind of a conclusion that there's many of the coastal communities have so many threads that pull us together on common grounds, that to come together and speak as one voice is stronger than individually going and talking about what we think, you know, state and federal policymakers should be doing. And so in thinking about that, we decided to hold a gathering of individuals from local communities, coastal communities, that have a understanding of the causes and effects of global climate change and the daily uptake of over 22 million tons of CO2 by the ocean, which is causing ocean acidification, have that basic understanding of those causes and effects, and then also have an understanding of the urgency that policymakers need to take action. And so with that in mind, we invited people to come to Homer officially starting tomorrow. In Homer, we're going to receive presentations from the state's experts and, for lack of better words, shakers and movers in how to address global climate change. And they're coming together, and we're going to receive presentations, and we're going to circle up afterwards, and we're going to draft a compact of by consensus and what we want federal and state policymakers to do now on addressing global climate change and ocean acidification.
Coastal communities, that's probably a significant constituency.
Well, it is. We have, representatives from Dillingham and Kodiak and Sitka and Petersburg and Gus Davis, and the city of Homer will be there, and the Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly people will be there. It's just a lot to get, local communities are, taking... They have a lot on their plate, and this is of great importance. And the idea is that once we form and we come to a compact drafted out, that we're going to take it back to our respective communities, and we're going to get formal signature signing of the compact from the local governing body. And then we're hoping that, and I think this will happen, others will follow. And so we're hoping that a momentum of consensus on the issues and what it's going to take for us to move beyond the business as usual and move into, a new culture and a new economy and a new way of thinking about how we go about our daily lives.
Yeah, in a way, the marketplace is changing, and that'll have its impacts. The public sentiment, in a sense, is ahead of public policy now, it seems. I mean, at least that's my perception as a talk show host in Alaska, that people have had burning concerns about this for about 2 years now. It's been like at the top of their agenda until the economic downturn. And yet, and they all talk about basically similar stuff about renewable energy and things like that, and how are we going to get with the program. And, slowly we've seen the policy apparatus come around to where we have a renewable energy fund, and then, good Lord, we actually have money in it. And now there's money actually on its way to communities for renewable energy projects. And you see, going to be a lot of wood burning going on all of a sudden, then you start thinking, well, wait a minute. what does it cost to go get that wood? It's kind of like with the tar sands. Chris Field announced that the carbon emissions were vastly ahead of the A2 scenario, which was not the one that they picked as the most likely one for society to follow. They thought there would be some moderation of the carbon use, but it turns out it's escalating. And it's, I don't know exactly why, but one can speculate that it's stuff like deforestation, that it's stuff like the tar sands, which take so much carbon put into it to get the carbon back out, that it's vastly more carbon intensive. And, of course, all the coal plants that are being built in China, all these are more carbon intensive than the energy sources that they are supplanting.
Well, that's all true. I mean, that's very good points you made. I mean, we're 38% more higher in parts per million than we were in pre-industrial levels, and half of that has increased over the past 30 years. And so we've just accelerated our burning of fossil fuels that have, just had a huge impact on climate change and ocean acidification. And I really just have to keep, every time I say climate change, it's imperative that I follow it up with ocean acidification, because hovering around 30% of all CO2 gets directly put into the ocean, which is causing, severe problems, or the potential of having severe problems unless we stop emitting and level off. I mean, when you talk about emissions reductions, we have to really think about what the IPCC says as far as what the recommendations are. They say in their report that we have to level off by 2015, and we have to get by 2050, we have to be, you know, between 60 and 80% less emissions. And that's at the old models. And so as when the new models come out, it's probably going to be even, you know, more aggressive action needs to take happen then. And then, you know, you mentioned China, and, you know, most of the emissions and the burning of fossil fuels, we Americans have benefited from greatly. I mean, we have just, our economy, our way of life, the way we move, how we've prospered during the industrial era here with the burning of fossil fuels has been, you know, a real huge benefit to us. I mean, we've just prospered. And these other countries, they're wanting to prosper too. And so the political ramifications and the negotiating that we have to do is going to be, you know, equity-based. In reality, if I should reframe that a little bit, when we get to the negotiating table in Copenhagen and coming up with a new Kyoto Agreement, it's going to be equity-based emissions reductions is going to be part of the discussion. So if we're going to do that, it's going to be even more a burden for us as far as figuring out how to reduce our emissions. So, but there is a lot of positive stuff and opportunity that's going to go along with it, Steve, as far as addressing climate change and moving into this new economy. I mean, there's incredible opportunity, and it's got to be the opportunity for our young people. I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm pulling gray hair out of my head, and I know a lot of my friends are, and we've all prospered, and it's when I look at my children, who are, you know, 9 and 10, I look at them and I go, this is the world I'm leaving you, and this is the opportunity that I'm leaving you, and the opportunity is going to be this new economy. So if you have children and you think about it in those terms, and you think about it in terms of the way of life and the economy that we're used to, particularly on coastal Alaska, it's just really imperative that we address it, and we urge our policymakers to move us into this new economy, to create incentives for business and individuals to prosper. And it's not all doom and gloom. There is some positive things if we take action.
Well, I'm sure Alaskans are going to want to weigh in on this, and this is something that could come up in their own communities. I would think, you know, this might be the reason this compact might end up being spread around to city councils and whatnot if you accomplish your intention. And so I'm sure our listeners are going to want to dialogue about this. So if you're ready, Alan Parks, we'll start taking some calls.
Okay.
All right. Let's go to Guy in Valdez first. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Guy.
Hey, Steve, is 38% of the people in the United States still don't believe in global warming? Is that right? Isn't that the last figures that anybody's mentioned about?
I don't really track that. Sometimes it's worse.
Yeah, and then, you know, right now with the winter we had, well, it was, you know, they say, oh, well, you know, the Earth is cyclical. You know, as far as the warming and the cooling and stuff. And you try and tell people that 2008 was still the ninth warmest year on record. And then with this winter we had, well, it was an El Nino. And, you know, and this is a very complicated topic when you talk about global warming. But I always like to say, okay, you know, let's not talk about global warming. Let's talk about the acidification of the ocean, because that's not cyclical. You know, you can't look back in our history.
Well, it is. It is cyclical. Yeah, it's actually.
It actually is.
Yeah, I understand that, but it is cyclical in a sense, in that over time, the carbon that goes into the ocean does end up in the sediments rather than staying in the water. It just takes a long time.
Well, and then I heard that it's going to be 1,000 years for all of these hydrocarbons that are, you know, if we were to stop burning fossil fuels right now, It's going to take 1,000 years for this hydrocarbon that's in the atmosphere now to finally dissipate. So, you know, whatever we do right now, we're still going to be dealing with, our great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren are still going to be dealing with what we do today. And or there might not be any grandchildren left, you know, if we don't do something. And you know, a fifth of all of the coral is gone in the oceans right now. If that was people, that would be over 1.2 billion people gone off the earth right now. You know, they say that that lobsters and the clams and the crabs and aren't the shrimp and oysters aren't going to be able to have shells pretty soon. And those little mussels out there that so many of these creatures are eating aren't going to be able to be there anymore. So, you know, the whole ecosystem is going to be gone pretty soon if we don't do something about this. And I'll listen to what you guys got to say. But, hey, good thing Homer's starting to wake up the rest of this state.
All right, Guy. Thank you. You got a shout-out there, Alan Parks.
Well, you know, I think the caller brings up some pretty good points. I think, you know, as far as, you know, if global warming is happening or not is really not something I like to debate about. I think that when you look at, you know, almost every major corporation in America is pretty much stopped debating it. You know, Shell Oil came out and said not too long ago, maybe a year and a half or 2 years ago, about, you know, for them, the debate is over. It's not their job to debate the science. And so, and they're doing, you know, taking actions to reduce their emissions. So I think if, and Walmart's doing, corporate America is addressing it. Walmart is looking at sustainability and carbon neutral stores. And you know, there's just a lot going on there in the corporate world, green building and all sorts of stuff to reduce emissions. I think as far as the ocean acidification goes, there's the caller is right on the mark. I mean, we're, you know, the if calcifiers are unable to make their shells because of ocean acidification, then we're looking at, you know, the impact on the food web that's going to be profound and long-lasting. And it's going to have a huge effect on, you know, people that rely on the ocean for a way of life as far as, you know, for the economy, subsistence foods. And actually, it's 100 times more faster than natural change has occurred over millions of years.
And that's a very good point. We'll get into that in the second half hour, too. The thing on the ocean acidification is the timetable is very much under debate. But what seems to happen is that natural systems respond with lurches rather than a graduated change. And things turn out to be have a lot of mix to them, a lot of geographic diversity. And the fact of the matter is there's never been money to research pteropods. There's never been money to research calcareous algae that are there symbiotically with the coral. There's never been money to research this. There's hardly any measurements, and they're just starting to get the buoys deployed, and the places where acidification is likely to be worst are likely to be in the north where we are, and we've got exactly one buoy out there in the Gulf of Alaska.
No, that's right. We do need to, you know, as there's some basic research that needs to be taken to be happening right now. You know, for instance, getting a baseline of pteropods. How many what's the biomass of pteropods, and how many are out there, and other calcifiers on the shelf break? And because it's, you know, ocean acidification is going to be seen at these upwelling parts more than others, and Alaska is going to be front and center to that because of the Gulf of Alaska and the currents that we have that come up against the shelf break. It's bringing that deep water up to the surface at key places that are productive to, you know, the fish that we eat and the fish that we need. You know, if pteropods supply approximately, you know, 60% of the food source for juvenile pink salmon, and it's unknown if those pteropods go away because they're unable to build shells, it's unknown if those salmon are going to be able to find another food source. And they're also competing with that food source with pollock and cod and other species. So we really need to get a baseline. And then the science, the economics, the economists and the scientists need to kind of work together to find out what the social and economic extent of the impacts and the cost is going to be. And policymakers, I mean, it's policy's got to really be flexible and be able to change as new information comes available, because as you pointed out, there's a lot we don't know, and it's you know, there's a lot we do know, and what we do know is kind of scaring us to, and we do need to find out more, and funding good research is part of what needs to have happen.
Well, you know, the way it seems to work with policy is that the policymakers, if they have wiggle room, will dodge difficult decisions, and it's only by creating a resistant body such as your compact organization that you're talking about that they realize, oh, I can't wiggle over there anymore.
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, everything, I mean, Homer's out ahead maybe officially with a document that the Homer Climate Action Plan, but, you know, you go to Petersburg and there's a, I was talking to a fellow in Petersburg and there's like six electric cars driving around Petersburg, if I have that right.
Yeah.
And Sitka has a local task force that's a little bit behind Homer, but they're going to come on. And I was just in Cordova last week, and Cordova is doing great work. I mean, I am so proud of what Cordova's doing. Dillingham's doing stuff. Dillingham's got, you know, they're trying to wrap around the cost of energy, and they're looking at different renewable energy projects there that are going to reduce their footprint and also bring their energy cost in line to what's reasonable. And so, you know, there's a lot going on. Kodiak has got they've done a emissions inventory, and they've got just a lot of great work going on there. So I think this compact and this gathering is just going to be in part bringing together everybody's collective knowledge and wisdom about what they're doing in their own community and what policies need to have need to have in place to move us forward. And we really do need we don't need waffle words on this.
All right. Thank you, Alan Parks. I think we'll take our break here before we go to more calls and to our next guest. So you just hang on with us. We'll get back to you as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Techcominco, creating jobs for Alaskans at the Red Dog and Pogo Mines.
Since the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change put out its last report, we have some more years of data now. And it leads to greater concern, and a new IPCC report is being drafted now. And we'll try and get into what might go into the making of that report, which is the consensus of the world's scientists, sponsored by their countries, on climate change. In a moment, on Talk of Alaska. We're talking now with Alan Parks, chairman, who was the chairman of the City of Homer Global Warming Task Force and is now part of a group of people from local governments who are coming together in Homer to see if they can't facilitate the process of municipal governments getting more involved in responding to climate change. And Alan, we had a caller from your area, Ingrid, that I'd like to bring on right now. Ingrid, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yeah, hi. I think some great points are being raised. And the previous caller who brought up the fact that I don't know for sure, but I'm sure his dad is probably correct, that it'll take 1,000 years to get rid of the carbon that's already in the atmosphere, most of which was put there and continues to be put there by the good old USA. And then Alan with this ocean.
Yeah, Ingrid, by the way, I think China just passed us.
Well, okay, you're right. I know China was upcoming last time I did the research, and that was a big worry. So I guess it's even worse then. And this ocean acidification that Alan brings up, that's really, really terrible. I think what's going to happen is we're going to start losing our food sources for human beings, and maybe that will wake people up. But I think just one more thing I wanted to bring up that hasn't been touched on right here in Alaska, besides the North Pole melting and also the South Pole, that shows there definitely is global warming, and it's happening so rapidly. It's not the age-old taking, you know, like 100,000 years to happen. It's been happening just quickly in the last 20 years. But it's also the permafrost in Alaska and Siberia is melting really rapidly, and that is releasing methane. And methane is one of the most terrible global warming gases there is. And scientists at UAF are concerned that once that methane cycle starts and creates even more warming that releases more methane, they call it a loop that will be impossible to stop. So what we're looking at here is a total eco-collapse of our planet, and cutting back on emissions isn't going to do it. We've got to go for clean energy now, and if you'll bear with this long-winded spiel here for just one more second so I can get to my point, I think Alaska can be at the cutting edge of that, and when it comes to policy, people have to take over because the big politicians are all controlled by the industry and start green enterprises that will bring money and jobs and everything to the bush where there's all these resources like wind and tidal action. And as far as Homer, I'd like to see them get a tidal power. I guess Cook Inlet has some of the biggest tides in the world. So there we go. So if anybody cared to comment on any of that.
All right, Ingrid, I will say, you know, from my point of view, you are looking at the you're speeding up the scenarios on a lot of those, especially Greenland, where they just realize it's still holding pretty much. I mean, Antarctica, where they realize it's still holding pretty much. But Greenland, there's definite concern there. And we've lost the satellite that did the main sensing on the mass balance on that huge ice sheet there. But, you know, and the methane is, well, I've talked to Romanofsky about that, and probably going to be another year or so before he has good measurements that he, you know, can get a better handle on how quickly that's proceeding. So, yeah, I'm keeping an eye on all those, and all those are concerns. And it is the speed at which these changes are taking place that, you know, compared to natural cyclical factors, is the real problem here. Alan, you still with us?
I am.
Okay.
I guess, you know, the caller, once again, brings up some pretty, you know, urgent points and actions that need to take place, and it's going to be. I tend to think that, you know, government is controlled by the people, and I would like to think that, you know, with action being taken at a local level and reasonable minds coming together to bring urgent need for solutions and to urge our policymakers to do what's necessary, I think there's hope. I think we're at a point where we need to.
All right, thank you, Ingrid.
We just need really to take action and at a local level and the where we're at with on a national sense for addressing global climate change is not because of our policymakers. It's because of the grassroots movement on this issue, and we are being effective on urging good policy. I mean, there's Waxman has a bill that he's going to be introducing. Boxer has something she's going to be introducing and is drafted out. Our own Senator Bagage is actually done great work in Anchorage to address climate change and has a policy that he's moving forward on. And I think with good, sound, collective voices on urging our decision makers to do the right thing, which is, you know, coming up with mandatory emissions reductions, coming up with incentives that will move our economy forward to meet those reductions, and that it won't be a burden. I mean, it will be a burden to change, but there's opportunity and there's challenges to be had, but there's opportunity to be had, and we're a smart race. I mean, you think back, we're very literate. We're very understanding of what's happening. And you think back when my grandfather was alive and raising a family. You know, I don't know. I mean, most of the people didn't even know how to read, you know, 60 years ago. I mean, everybody knows how to read now. Everybody knows what's happening. I mean, it doesn't, you know, if you agree with it or not, we're smart enough to take the issue and address it. And I like the it's a big challenge. It's a huge challenge. And it's going to take everybody to come together. I mean, someone was saying during the election, the presidential election, they were saying, if we can put a man on the moon, you know, we can address this climate change. And then I was kind of saying that recently, and someone said, boy, putting a man on the moon would be easier. And actually, it probably would have been when I got to thinking about it. But I think that we can address this, but it's really has got to happen now. And the discussion's got to be far and wide and transparent, and we've got to engage. And this compact and this gathering that's happening is happening specifically for coastal communities, but I'm sure that what's going to come out of there, you know, interior communities will resonate to it too.
Okay, well, we'll ground truth that in just a moment. Alan Parks, you are backing up your words with actions, and I want to thank you very much for being on the show today.
My pleasure.
All right. Alan Parks, who is heading up a local move, a move of local governments to generate constituency, I guess you would say, for more response to climate change, human-caused climate change. I want to turn now to the co-author of a report that's in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences came out today. It says, assessing dangerous climate change through an update of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, Reasons for Concern. Michael Oppenheimer is in the Department of Geosciences and the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University. Thanks for joining us from New Jersey there, Michael.
My pleasure to be here today.
Well, this report is short, but still difficult to read somehow.
It's a science paper. What do you expect?
Well, the thing is, you're dealing with intangibles and trying to render them tangible, I guess you would say, or sensitivities. But you have these, what you're calling embers, I guess that's kind of the lingo. where there's a scale of, what the big risks are, and depending on how imminent they are, is how dark this finger, as it were, gets as it goes up, and the more serious the concerns are. And what you guys did is took this graph that the IPCC put out of all these sensitivities that we have to our climate changing and basically made it a whole lot darker. Isn't that right?
I think it's a simple way to put it, yes. I mean, we are faced with a number of substantial risks due to climate change. More drought, so threat to the food and water system, higher sea levels, perhaps relatively rapid changes in features like sea level, which would be very hard to adapt to, changes in extreme events like hurricanes or heat waves or other intense storms, economic dislocations with some areas of the earth suffering more than others, but then eventually all areas suffering economic declines in a relative sense due to climate change. And this is a lot of information spread out over a very large number of areas of academic expertise. So scientists generally have trouble putting it all together. You know, how much does a bigger drought in areas which might affect 100 million people's food supply balance against the risk of higher sea level, which may affect hundreds of millions of people along the coast? Those are not factors that are easily aggregated in any way. So what we tried to do, really going back to the report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change 8 years ago, we tried to find a way to assemble the risks and provide some kind of measure of whether the risks are getting worse over time. That is, if our understanding of the climate problem is such that the risks look more severe today than they did a few years ago.
Okay, so you got five of them. Risk to unique and threatened systems, risk of extreme weather events, distribution of events.
Yeah, by the way, risk to unique and threatened systems would be, for instance, the Arctic.
Yeah.
The Arctic sea ice, the tundra, the polar bears, etc. That's an intangible example.
So the distribution, in other words, whether there's many or few areas, the aggregate impacts, and...
That's whether the world is better off or worse off economically, let's say.
And then the risk of large-scale discontinuities, which eludes me. What is that one?
Well, to put it in English, that means big stuff happening that you don't want to see, like the collapse of one of the ice sheets.
Oy. Okay, well, I'm relieved to say that one didn't get dark all the way down to the bottom, whereas you take...
Did not get dark. We're not there yet.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Whereas,
but some of this other stuff is happening already.
Yeah.
And, the basic message is that since we last did this exercise 7-8 years ago, that the judgment is that all of these risks are more severe now than they were. And the reason for that is a combination of factors. One, we learn more, and we know more about the risks. Number two, stuff is starting to happen. You know, the sea ice is melting away, for instance, in your neck of the woods. Forests are coming under threat. Drought has become more persistent. These are changes which are by and large associated with the global warming trend. We have 7-8 years more of data. And the third thing, which is very important, is we've had some episodes in the last few years which teach us that we're not very good at dealing with a changing climate. For instance, Hurricane Katrina, whether it was due to global warming or not, teaches us a lesson about how hard it is to deal with severe hurricanes. There was a heat wave in 2003, which did in over 35,000 people due to the direct and indirect effects of the heat. It taught us that governments aren't very good at preparing us to deal with these kinds of intense climate extremes of the sort we'll get more of in the future. In fact, that summer, which was a once-in-a-thousand-year event, will, if the projections are right, become more or less a typical summer at the end of this century. So.
Yeah.
We've learned a lot in the last 7 or 8 years, and all of it is kind of in a negative direction as far as the climate problem is concerned. So we pulled all the risk bars down, bringing the risk closer, bringing the high-risk terrain closer to where we are now.
So, Michael, maybe you could tell us a little bit about your background. I know your co-author, Stephen Schneider. I've known him for some years, but I'm not real acquainted with your work. Have you been on this game for a while now?
I've been playing this game, so to speak, not as long as Stephen has, but I began in the late 1970s doing research on the atmosphere, and then during the 1980s I worked as a senior scientist at the Environmental Defense Fund, one of the big national environmental groups, where I started trying to turn the environmental community in the United States toward being interested in global warming. And more recently, in 2002, I became a professor at Princeton in both geosciences, where I do research on things like the ice sheets, and the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs, where my work focuses on how do you reach international agreements to solve problems like this.
Michael, maybe you can help me. I'm talking to glaciologists and getting conflicting reports on what's really going on with Greenland, with some saying, look, there are unanticipated cascade effects as these tidewater glaciers go out, that there are effects that are rippling their way right up into the ice sheet there. And others are saying that that's way overblown, and as near as we can tell, we're getting more replacement by snow than we're losing by melt.
The truth on Greenland is there's more snow in the middle, but there's more melting and movement of ice into the sea at the edges. And on balance, the picture is very clear that on balance, Greenland is losing ice. It's getting smaller, which means it's making a bigger and bigger contribution to sea level rise. The real question is not what's happening now. We know what's happening. And it isn't even really is global warming causing it. Global warming is undoubtedly causing a big chunk of it. The question is, how fast can the process go in the future? And there we have quite a bit of uncertainty. We're not sure. We're pretty sure that if you raise the temperature another few degrees, the Greenland ice sheet is a goner. The real question is how fast that would happen. If it happens over the course of a few hundred years, it's a rate of sea level rise that we probably could not deal with. And, you know, it would mean abandoning large areas of what's now the coast. On the other hand, if it happened over a few thousand years, we would have much more time to adjust and adapt. It would be unpleasant. There would be big land losses. But they would happen so slowly that it wouldn't be a disaster in any sense.
Yeah.
And we just don't know. That's our uncertainty in that problem. It's very big.
Yeah, well, Jim Overland came up here and announced, and I also checked this out with Mark Serez, who says pretty much the same thing, that, it looks like this record sea ice loss that we've had for 2 years now, that may be about as far as it recedes for a while, but...
the sea ice is a different problem.
Yeah.
Land ice is one thing, sea ice is another.
Oh, yeah, it's very much a different problem. This one has to do with the how much multi-year ice there is and how well it can withstand the solar heating.
Right. Sea ice melting doesn't contribute to sea level rise, but it has other problems that it creates that you're very familiar with. And the thing about the sea ice is we just, the models that we have that try to project what's happening in the system have had to play a little catch-up baseball. They haven't been very good at predicting the rate at which the sea ice has been retracting. On the other hand, there have been arguments about whether it's gone over some tipping point and we can't, the summer sea ice is gone, essentially, pretty soon, or whether it's going to stabilize after going a little further. And there are different views in the scientific community. But this is one of the things about the climate problem. There's a lot of uncertainty. There always has been and there always will be. But that shouldn't be an excuse for not acting to slow the emissions, because we can't do much about the scientific uncertainty except gradually learn. But we can do a lot about emissions, and reducing emissions means cutting the risk.
Yeah, and Michael Oppenheimer, I would say that's your bottom line message. Let's give you a chance to talk to a few Alaskans up in the interior. Mary joins the program. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Mary.
Thank you, Steve. Number one, thank you so much for this show. I think global climate change is the number one priority we should be working on. It's going to make the whole economy problem look small when we try to fix this the longer we wait. Here in the interior, we've been working on climate change. Over the last year, we've had a task force that's been meeting trying to establish the scientific impacts and to come up with a prioritized list of actions that the government can do. And our main concerns here are thawing permafrost, as one of your earlier callers mentioned. Once that starts thawing, there's no bringing it back. And the methane released is four times more polluting than CO2, so we really are going to have a problem. And here in the interior, the forest is becoming more diseased because of warmer summers, and the trees are getting pests in them, and the chance of forest fires is increasing. And as we've seen in other parts of the world, these fires are getting so large they really can't be fought anymore. And the air quality in the interior of Alaska has really suffered this winter. With the price of fuel, a lot of people have switched to burning wood and have purchased really inefficient stoves that have just put out a lot of pollutants. And Fairbanks is down in a bowl, and all that pollutants just settles in, and the air quality has been horrible in Fairbanks this winter. So I think it's really brought things home to people, and we are trying to work out some actions we can do to help solve the problem here.
Mary, that was very nuts and bolts.
Thank you.
Stay with us here, and I'll give Michael a chance to respond here as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from TelAlaska, a telecommunications company proud to support public broadcasting, sharing the spirit of communications across the Great Land. Voice data and Wi-Fi technologies at TelAlaska, on the web at telalaska.com.
Well, Michael, except for the people that are very concerned that so many different seal species are getting hard to find, and the people whose communities are getting wiped out because the fall storms, it doesn't freeze up fast enough, and the fall storms make big waves onto the coast, eating up the bluff. You've got a kind of a thumbnail of some of the very nuts and bolts and solid concerns that Alaskans have here, and I thought I'd give you a chance to kind of respond.
Well, you know, I have great sympathy for what's going on up there. Alaska's, to use the metaphor that's overused, the canary in the coal mine here, because the warming is higher at the higher latitudes. You've got a lot of resources at stake up there. I've been in Alaska. In fact, I was on the North Slope a long time ago, and it's just, fantastic wilderness. And the idea that that wilderness is going to be sort of turned into something entirely different is personally upsetting to me, and the lives of people in places along the coast that are already getting battered. This is all very troubling. The situation with the forest, of course, extends well down into Canada and even into the western lower 48. So we have a real serious problem which has already gotten underway, and it's paramount importance that our government focus on it. Our government in Washington took way too long to focus on it, and that's why state and local governments have started to get active, and that's it's a great thing to hear that there are things going on up in Alaska. But really, unless the U.S. moves forward at the federal level, it's going to be impossible to engage the other countries that need to belly up to the bar and get moving, like China, India, Brazil, Malaysia, etc.
Yeah, I'm thinking on the diplomatic level, this is really, really going to be tough.
It's a tough issue, but look, everybody thought that somehow we could never live in the same world with the Soviet Union, and we'd annihilate each other with nuclear weapons, and it didn't happen. And part of the reason it didn't happen is that in the end, countries do stare each other in the eye and decide on what's their self-interest. And it's in China's self-interest, just like it's in our self-interest, to turn this around, and eventually they will realize that, and they are coming to realize it.
Well, Alan, you know as well as I do that international law survives by ignoring things, and right now they're ignoring the islands that are disappearing in the high tides.
It's true that a lot of problems have already arisen and not been dealt with, but this one is so big, and it's gradually crept up high on the agenda of most of the big emitting countries, that I suspect we're going to see a turnaround in the next few years. But it will require political leadership, and if the Obama administration is serious about what they say about this issue, I think we finally will get the political leadership.
Let's go to Chief Paul, joins the program from Wasilla. Well, welcome to Talk of Alaska, Paul.
Good morning. I have the solution. You're hearing it first right here.
Thank you.
The military, you get rid of that. Send their budget and everything out of state, that's gone. You take the tourists, you throw them out, put them on their boats, go back, that's gone. You get rid of the retired military, that's gone. You get rid of the jets coming from overseas and all of the hub airplane flights and all the hotels and the sports fishermen. You get rid of them, that's gone. You get rid of the government and state mines and pollutions, and you their giveaway of the lands, and that's gone. And the McKinley tourists, you get rid of those buses, and that's gone. They're all people problems, and that's what it is. That's where it begins, and that's where the rubber meets the pavement. And until then, you guys can talk till you're blue in the face, and you're still talking to yourself. And as for giving that guy that job, Don and Homer, to talk about it and count it and everything, and he take the money and run with this big corporation to talk about it and pay himself, that ain't no good either. So you better do something. Thank you.
All right, Paul. Thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Barrow now. And Roy, welcome to Talk of Alaska, Roy.
Just a quick comment. I appreciate the show that's going on, but we need to have a reality check. And our people on the North Slope and everywhere else that are native have kept an eye on the environment for thousands of years, and there is definitely a change, especially with the ice. And what concerns me is that 75 years ago, every 50 miles, the federal government made a two-line site for defense. And because of the thawing or of the ice and the erosion that is happening every year, it's like taking off 45 feet. And what is happening on the North Slope is the pollutions. Every two-line site had a landfill. And everything that was left when they abandoned all the two-line sites, like every 50 miles, from here all the way to Greenland, I believe, and the landfills are being exposed by the erosion. And there's pollutants that are affecting our environment at the same time. And what gets me is that when policies are being made and say that the ducks are being harmed, and then they blame us, who are subsistence hunters and that that eat the eider ducks and stuff like that, and then they blame us for the decline of those animals. Same thing with the polar bears. They say that the polar bears are declining, but they are not. And we need to have a reality check here. And all these so-called experts from all over, really is a theory, and really their opinions, and we need to weed those out too and find out what is really happening within the global warming. But we know for a fact the ice is receding, and for a fact a lot of things that are happening. But right now, with what we are hunting, there's still a lot of seals, there's still a lot of bearded seals, there's still a lot of polar bears. But a lot of people are playing politics with what is happening.
Roy, I want to thank you very much. We'll get back to that dew line issue, too. But thank you so much for calling from the North Slope. Michael Oppenheimer, thank you for being with us today and filling in for Stephen Schneider.
It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, it's almost impossible to fill in for the loquacious Mr. Schneider.
All right. I don't talk as fast as Steve does.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. We'll try and talk Iditarod on the next show on Talk of Alaska. Duncan Moon's our managing editor. It's Mr. Len Anderson on the phones, Gooseberry Peter on controls. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.